One will cite an example of a brief positive contact reported to me by a subject who met a clearly defined affiliated soul. I was walking alone on a beach, totally devastated after being fired from my job. A man appeared and we struck up a conversation. I did not know him and was never to see him again in that life. But that afternoon he came up to me with ease and we talked. I felt myself unloading my problems on this stranger. He calmed me down and gave me greater perspective of my job situation. After about an hour he was gone. Now I see he was an acquaintance in the spirit world from another group. It was no accident we bumped into each other that day. He was sent to me. However, it is with soulmates that we have our most profound contacts. While considering this book, I was asked by people to be sure and give them one detailed case of a love story between primary soulmates. Being a romantic myself, this request was irresistible. Case 46. There was an urgency to Maureen's voice when she called me for an appointment. This was in the days before one had long waiting lists of over a year. Maureen lived close to my office in California and wondered if she might see me with a male friend who was on his way from New York to meet her for the first time. I asked her about this friend she had never met and the following story unfolded. 3 months before, on a computer website, a group of some 25 people interested in life after death formed what is known in computer parlance as a chat room. Conversations are initiated online, in this way for people with similar interests. All this had to be explained to me because I have little knowledge of computers. Maureen said that she and a man named Dale found they were so closely tuned in their discussions about the topic of soulmates they felt connected in a strange way. She added that it was uncanny how Dale mirrored her thoughts. They decided to set up their own private chat room for further computer conversations. Maureen and Dale learned that they were born only a few months apart 50 years ago in an area around San Francisco. They talked about their unsuccessful marriages and a mutual feeling of unexplained sadness, about seeking something neither had ever found that would open their hearts. Their conversations mostly centered around life after death, and Dale mentioned reading my work. Soon, the two decided to meet each other in California and see me for a combined regression session at the same time. I agreed to an appointment day that turned out to be the day after they first met. They arrived at my office starry-eyed and I remarked that they were already in a trance state and didn't need me. The moment they saw each other there was instant recognition. Maureen said, the way we smiled at each other, the expression in our eyes, the sound of our laughter together, the connecting vibrations as we shook hands, created a euphoria that was so strong we were oblivious to everything going on around us. I will relate this case from the standpoint of Maureen, since she was my initial contact. During intake, I learned that there had been times in her life when she had a feeling of déjà vu when she heard music from the 1920s or saw dancers do the Charleston wearing flapper dresses from that era. Maureen also told me that since childhood she had been bothered by a recurring nightmare of sudden death. It is my custom to take subjects into the spirit world after death from their last life so they will not miss the natural wonders of normal spirit world entry. The advantages of this hypnosis technique are many, including learning if any disrupting body imprints from the last life have been carried forward into the client's current physical body. 2. Speed up this process by taking subjects directly into the spirit world, say from their mother's womb, causes them to arrive disoriented. It would be like taking someone into the back of a house and asking them to describe the front. This accelerated procedure for spirit world entry would also cause them to circumvent a variety of orientation stations. These stops might be vital if the death preceding this entry was sudden and traumatic. By not skipping over death scenes, the client is actually better protected from painful physical memories. Upon my direction to move to the most significant scene in her past life, Maureen took me to the events leading up to her death. This is often a signal of trouble ahead and past life facilitators must be prepared to deal with death scenes that can be horrific. What follows is a condensed version of Maureen's story. Dr. N, are you a man or woman? S, a girl, Really? Dr. N, what is your name? S, Samantha. Sam for short. Dr. N, where are you and what are you doing at this moment? S, I'm at my bedroom dressing table getting ready to go to a party. Dr. N, what is the party all about? S, pause, and then light laughter. It's, for me, today is my 18th birthday and my parents are giving me a coming out party. Dr. N, well, happy birthday, Sam. What is the date today? S, after a brief hesitation, July 26, 1923. Dr. N, since you are at your dressing table, one would like you to look in your mirror and describe to me what you see. S, I'm blonde, with my hair up high tonight. I'm wearing a white silk gown. It's my first real grown-up party dress. I'm going to put on my new white high-heeled shoes. Dr. N, you sound smashing. S, with a knowing smile, Rick better think so. Dr. N, who is Rick? S, now distracted and flushed, Rick is, my guy, my date for tonight. I've got to finish my makeup, he will be here soon. Dr. N, listen, Sam, I'm sure you can talk to me while finishing your makeup because I don't want to slow you down. Tell me, are you serious about Rick? S, flushes again, you, but one don't want to appear too eager. I'm playing hard to get. Rick thinks he's the cat's meow, but one know he wants me. Dr. N, I can see this is an important party. I suppose that he will be honking soon for you to run out to his car? S, annoyed, absolutely not. Oh, he'd like that, all right, but he will ring the doorbell in a proper fashion and the maid will let him in and make him wait downstairs. Dr. N, so the party is some distance from your house? S, not too far, it's in a posh mansion in downtown San Francisco. Dr. N, okay, Sam, now move forward in time to the party downtown and explain to me what is going on. S, bubbling, I'm having a wonderful time. Rick looks gorgeous, of course. My parents and their friends are telling me how grown up I look. There is music, dancing, a lot of my friends are congratulating me, and, my subject's face grows dark for a fleeting moment, there is a lot of drinking my parents don't know about. Dr. N, does this trouble you? S, fighting off a new set of feelings by quickly running one hand through her hair and returning to the moment. Oh, drinking is always a part of these affairs, it makes us gay and carefree. I'm drinking too, Rick and some of his friends snuck in the liquor. Dr. N, move forward now to the next significant event this evening and explain what is taking place. S, subject's face softens and her voice is more halting, Rick and I are dancing, he is pressed so close to me, we are on fire, he whispers in my ear that we must get away from the party to be alone for a while. Dr. N, and how does this make you feel, Samantha? S, excited, but something seems to be holding me back, I overcome it, I'm willful. One assume it's a feeling of my parents' disapproval, yet, I sense it's something more. I shake it off in favor of the excitement of the moment. Dr. N, stay with this emotion. What happens next? S, we leave by a side entrance to avoid being seen and go to Rick's car. It's a beautiful new red roadster convertible. It's a marvelous night and the top is down. Dr. N, then what do you and Rick do, Sam? S, we get in the car. Rick takes the pins out of my hair so it will blow free. He gives me a deep kiss. Rick wants to show off, we roar out of a long driveway into the street. Dr. N, can you describe the location of the road and the direction you take? S, now growing very nervous. We are going south down the Pacific Coast Road out of San Francisco. Dr. N, what is the ride like for you, Sam? S, for one final fleeting moment the subject is free of her premonitions, I feel so alive. It's a warm night and the wind in my hair blows the strands all over my face. Rick has one arm around me. He squeezes me and says I am the most beautiful girl in the world. We both know we're in love. Dr. N, one notice my subject's hands now start to shake and her body grows more rigid, I take her hand because one suspect what is coming. Now, Samantha, I want you to understand that as you continue to talk to me, I will be with you every step of the way so I can move you quickly through anything that may happen. You know this, don't you? S. Faintly. Yes, Dr. N. Move to the time when things begin to change on this drive with Rick and describe the action. S. Subject's entire body now starts to shake. Rick has been drinking too much and the road is getting more curvy. The turns are sharper and Rick only has one hand on the wheel. We are near a hilly section, close to the ocean. There is a cliff. The car is all over the road, now shouting, Rick, slow down. Dr. N. Does he? S. Crying now, oh, God, no. He won't. He is laughing, and looking at me and not the road. Dr. N. Quickly now, Sam, keep going. S. With a sob, we miss the next curve. The car is in space. We are crashing into the ocean. I'm dying. The water, so cold, can't breathe. Oh, Rick. Rick, we stop while I begin rapid desensitization of this traumatic memory while at the same time bringing Samantha's soul out of her physical body. I remind her she has been through physical death many times before and she will be all right. Samantha explains that she is reluctant to go because her young life was only starting. She didn't want to leave Rick, but the pulling sensation away from the ocean was too insistent. When I began my research on the soul, I assumed that when two people such as Samantha and Rick died together, they would also enter the spirit world together. I have found this not to be true in death scenes, with one exception. Small children who are killed with those who love them rise with that person. I will elaborate on this further in Chapter 9 under Souls of the Young. Even primary soulmates killed at the same moment will normally rise up by separate routes on their own vibrational lines. I felt that this loss of companionship was a little sad until it was made clear to me that souls are met by their guides and friends from the spirit world at the appropriate time and place. Each soul requires their own rate of ascension, which includes orientation stops and energy rejuvenation, even if they are returning to the same soul group. This was true for Rick and Samantha. Dr. N., do you see Rick anywhere? S., no, I'm trying to resist the pulling which wants me to turn around and face upwards. I want to continue to face the ocean. I want to help Rick. Dr. N., does the force eventually turn you around in the proper direction away from the Pacific Ocean? S., subject is now quiet and resigned, but mournful as well. Yes, I am now far above the earth. Dr. N., this is a question I usually ask people. Do you want to say goodbye to your parents before going further? S., oh, no, not right now, later I will, now I just want to go. Dr. N., I understand. Tell me, what do you see next, Samantha? S., the eye of a tunnel, opening and closing, coordinating its movement with my movement. I pass through and feel much lighter. It's so bright now. Someone in a robe is coming toward me. In Dale's session, we learned he was Rick and his memories corroborated those of Maureen. While Samantha apparently lived a few seconds after the crash and rose out of the ocean, Rick's soul bailed out while the car was still in the air. When I related this story to a Dallas audience, a lady loudly scolded, "Isn't that just like a man?" I told her that when the mind knows there is no chance of surviving imminent devastation to the body, souls may leave a moment before actual death. In this way, the soul emerges with their energy more intact. After the sessions with Dale and Maureen were completed, I met with these primary soulmates for a review of what we had learned. Maureen explained that whenever she drove down Highway 1, south of San Francisco, she would inexplicably get very nervous and apprehensive at a certain section on the coast road. Now she knew why. I hoped my deprogramming of her death scene in 1923 would also clear up the recurring nightmares of sudden death. A month later, Maureen wrote and confirmed this nightmare was finally gone. The wonders of synchronicity became evident in this case when Dale told me that one of the reasons he left the area where he was born was because he felt uncomfortable driving around San Francisco. You would think that the time we spend in the spirit world between lives should eliminate all residual effects of our past life experiences. In most cases it does, but, as I have said, some people do carry physical and emotional body imprints from one life to the next. This is especially true if that imprint bears upon a particular karmic lesson in the life to come. Why were these primary soulmates separated in their current lives for 50 years? To understand this, we must start with the dynamics of their cluster group. Dale and Maureen come from a level I soul group. In varying degrees, these 12 souls are intense fighters and risk takers. Their guide regularly takes them to nearby groups just so they can see how other groups function with more peace and harmony. Dale and Maureen told me these visitations were interesting, but they found peaceful souls sort of boring. Certainly, there are members of their group who are less restless, but Rick, Dale isn't one of them. In his current life he was an army ranger who served 3 tours in Vietnam. "I didn't expect to come back," he told me, "and that would have been okay. Because he likes living on the edge of danger, he left the service after the war because being a peacetime soldier was too dull." After the car crash in 1923, the group's senior guide picked up Rick, who spent considerably more time in debriefing and orientation than did Samantha. When he did return to the group, Rick was very chagrined. In a tender scene of energy caressing, Rick told his primary soulmate how sorry he was for cutting off her young life. It was not clear from the session just how much they both knew about the possibility of the crash in advance. They have been lovers in numerous past lives, many involving turmoil. Although Dale and Maureen incarnated at the same time in this life and in the same place as their life in the 1920s, they were not destined to meet while young. The same sensory experience and emotional energy from this geographical location simply were part of the conditions for meeting much later in their current lives. These soulmates both knew going into their current life that conditions would not be right for their meeting until many years had passed. Dale, especially, needed to feel the frustration of years of longing for the right woman to come along. He is not a careless, irresponsible man today. Samantha Morson also required the maturity she did not yet possess in her relationship with Rick in the 1920s. Neither Dale nor Maureen take life for granted at this stage of their conjunction. They have both been through considerable heartache without each other. My work with this couple ended with both essentially making the same declaration. Maureen said, "We are completing our healing by a clear respect for the sanctity of life and importance of forgiveness. Now that we both know the meaning of loss, we are going to treasure the time we have left together in this life." Before closing this section on soulmates, I should add that many soulmates have a preparation class just before their next incarnation. A feature of this dress rehearsal with our guides is a final review of important issues in the life to come. One aspect of this prep class might also include 2 soulmates going off alone and sending visual images to each other of what they will look like in their new human bodies and under what circumstances they are going to meet. In Journey of Souls, I wrote a chapter citing examples of this sort of preparation for embarkation. Soulmates don't always get together just before departure. Then too, depending upon the karma involved, sometimes one soul knows more than the other about their future meeting and what that person will look like. Here is a short example of a soulmate discussing meeting his future wife. "One was permitted to see my wife in the screening room for the next life. She was an attractive aerobics instructor who I would meet in a gym. I studied her body and facial features carefully because I didn't want to mess up our meeting, as I had done in my prior life. The scent of her body bathed in sweat was embedded in my mind, her gestures, her smile, and most of all her eyes. The moment I saw her in this life, it was like 2 magnets pulling together. Linkages between spiritual and human families. As a rule, members of the same soul group do not return in their next incarnations as members of the same genetic human family. This means, contrary to American Indian tradition, a grandfather's soul would typically not return to the body of his grandson. I have emphasized the opposition souls have for genetic reincarnation in Chapter 4, Undersoul Division, and again in Chapter 5 with DNA. It is limiting and even redundant for souls who wish to learn fresh lessons to return to bodies having the same heredity, ethnicity, cultural environment, and perhaps the same geographic setting as they had in a former life. By incarnating in different families around the globe in each life, souls are able to take advantage of the great variety of human body choices. This variety is what gives depth to our incarnations on Earth. In unusual cases, our guides may be indulgent with souls who have strong feelings about unfinished karmic business within a particular family and wish to return to the same family. These souls may be given another crack at addressing a serious wrong done to them, or to correct harm they have caused another in the family. They could return as children of a new generation, but within the same lifetime of those people who were involved with the karmic events requiring their attention. I want to stress these occurrences of genetic reincarnation for karmic purposes are rare. It is far more likely the soul would return to another family with peripheral associations to the family of their former life to redress a serious wrong. Nevertheless, this too would be a very unconventional decision, especially in cases of personal injury to the soul, because it smacks of revenge. Although souls typically do not incarnate in the same hereditary family they had in past lives, members of the same soul group most definitely choose new families where they can be together. Members of soul groups tend to be associated in each life by blood ties and geographic proximity. What sort of roles do they choose? I'm sure readers of this book could sit down and draw up a chart showing significant members of their family, friends, lovers and even acquaintances to see who might be the most likely candidates for their own soul family. In Chapter 5, Figure 7,1 charted the color auras of a soul family in their current life. Figure 10 is a diagram showing how a group of souls incarnated into human families in order to stay connected to one another over the past 3 centuries. My central subject in this diagram is Ruth. Please note that from 1 century to the next, the family heredity is completely different despite the genealogical overtones of my chart. Figure 10 is an abbreviated version of Ruth's spiritual friends in human bodies. There are 6 souls listed from her own cluster group and 2 from an affiliated group to be found in each century. Figure 10, Spiritual and Human Genealogy, Wife. A sense primary A registered companion no affiliated, this web diagram illustrates primary, companion and affiliated soulmates who have incarnated into bodies related to the lives of the subject, Ruth, over the past 3 centuries. Each generational line outward from the center represents the same soul in different bodies. Ruth appears in the center of the diagram and each of the connecting lines from the center outward represents the same soul assuming different family roles relating to Ruth, from the 20th century back to the 18th century. We can see that Ruth's primary soulmate in this life, is her husband. In Ruth's last life, this soul was her best friend, and in the life before, her wife when she was a male in the 18th century. Ruth's primary soulmate has a halo color tinted with protective yellow while Ruth's own halo is a mixture of white and blue tints, indicating clarity and love of learning. These primary soulmates have mated on a fairly regular basis for some 7,000 years since their first life together. Besides the companion souls in Ruth's soul group, I have also shown 2 affiliated souls from a nearby group. These souls are my subject's current father and mother. The roles they played in the 19th century were her grandmother and grandfather respectively. In the 18th century, these same 2 souls were Ruth's aunt and uncle. Ruth's chart represents 1 typical client. Every soul group has its own subtle variations of human family preferences. One had a client the same week I saw Ruth who is extremely close to her mother. The mother's soul was a member of that client's soul group and was her sister in the life before. Grandparents often have a great influence in our early lives as non-judgmental confidants. I often find that a favorite grandparent in this life was a sibling or best friend in a former life. The social dynamics of intimate human contact are so powerful that in most of my cases the roles souls play in our lives and we in theirs directly bear on a group's karmic lessons. When we are hurt by someone close to us in life, or caused them hurt resulting in alienation and separation, it is because they volunteered to teach us lessons of some sort while learning lessons themselves. These lessons better prepare both parties for future relationships, as case 47 will show. I should also point out that peripheral roles in our lives by hundreds of affiliated souls in nearby groups may go on for generations. Because of space, one did not list all these souls on Ruth's past life chart in figure 10. An example of one important affiliated soul not included here is a soul called Zenda, who was Ruth's favorite teacher in the 6th grade. We found that in the last century, Zenda was a supportive next-door neighbor. In the 18th century, Zenda was the owner of a business that employed this subject. The web design of figure 10 is appropriate when we consider all the interrelationships of people whose own lives are woven into our own. The psychological profiles of primary, companion and affiliated souls in a client's current and past lives is very instructive when detailed in a genealogical type chart. In each of the three past centuries we found another leading actor in Ruth's lives who was from an affiliated soul group. There was not space for her in figure 10 either. This soul, known as Ortia, assumed roles involving jealous, unemotional and manipulative people. She was sent to test Ruth's trusting nature so she would learn to recover more quickly from the hurt and deal with it in a healthy manner. While this same individual would also demonstrate good qualities in human temperament, the negatives were very constant. In Ruth's current life, Ortia is her mother-in-law. In the life before, this soul played the role of a close friend who betrayed her. There is evidence the karmic cycles with Ortia assuming roles as a protagonist will end soon for Ruth. Ruth is a warm, passionate and tender person. Her primary soulmate has aspects of these qualities but is also tenacious, brutally frank and decisive. Many other souls in figure 10 are rather reserved and quiet. They also have character similarities of perfectionism and stubbornness. One soul in the group is sloppy, easygoing and more complacent than the rest. He is my client's brother, Andy, in her current life. This soul volunteered to be Ruth's husband in the last century as a change of pace for her. During that life, Ruth's primary soulmate chose the role of a male friend. They were so drawn to each other they had an affair that almost destroyed Ruth's marriage with Andy. She finally realized in this past life that Andy, an uncustomary mate to be sure, was a person who opened her mind in a relaxed way to a more optimistic existence where she would learn to appreciate each day and see more humor in life to complement her naturally warm nature. Although not a great love match, Ruth found tolerance and playfulness with Andy as her husband in the 19th century. Meanwhile, her primary soulmate was coping with a new challenge of being married to someone else whose character was much more confrontative than Ruth's. I don't wish to leave the impression that not being married to your primary soulmate is a formula for discontent. As a matter of fact, I have had clients who have deliberately alternated mates in a series of lives with three or two souls from their inner circle to meet certain challenges. Although the souls of Ruth and Andy tried this for the first time in the 19th century, the results were mostly positive. Reuniting with souls who have hurt us, now that we have an idea of the roles different soulmates can play in our lives, I want to discuss a specific aspect of these associations that is of interest to people. I am often asked what it is like to see someone in our soul group right after a life where they have hurt us in some way. The philosopher Heidegger said, "No one else can love for you or feel your pain." This statement may be true on earth, but not in the spirit world. Souls are capable of getting into the minds of their friends and feeling just what they feel. They do this for reasons of empathy, a desire for understanding and to evaluate the disruptive behavior of each other in the last life. In case 47,1 have chosen a man who had a rough start in his last life with an abusive, tyrannical father who was never satisfied with anything he did. For simplification, I will use the Earth names of these players, with my subject being Ray and his father as Carl. Ray was a troubled boy who grew up lacking self-worth, and his entire adult life was spent trying to conquer these negative feelings. Ray hid his sensitivity from others by building protective walls around himself. What happened when father and son met again in the spirit world is the substance of this case. We are going to sit in on what Ray called a motivational critiquing session with Carl.